One of the most popular podcast shows that we've produced in the last year was an interview with author Robert Aquinas McNally, who shared tales of John Muir and Muir's racist attitudes that many of us, myself included, were not aware of. Due to the popularity of McNally's podcast interview, we've decided to reshare it. Come along and join author Robert Aquinas McNally, the author of Cast Out of Eden, for a most illuminating conversation about the hidden story of John Muir. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a conversation with Robert Aquinas McNally, the author of Cast Out of Eden. And you go by Bob, right?
Formally, I'm Robert, but Bob's fine with me, Tom. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Backstory of your book, Cast Out of Eden. What spurred you to write the book?
This book actually, curiously, has this root in the prior book I wrote called The Modoc War. That book was published in November of 2017, and it was a project that I'd been working on for several years. When I started that book, which is a narrative nonfiction story of what happened in the war, I really thought it was going to be a very standard cowboys and Indian story, where the cowboys are the good guys and the Indians are the bad guys. And I found out as I did the research that that wasn't true at all, and that the Indians were really terribly wronged and used and became really the targets of what was a part of the California genocide. And it was the most established, long-lasting Indian war in the state of California. The curious thing about that was, in the course of that research, I found out that John Muir had visited the Modoc War battleground in northeastern California around what is now Lavabeds National Monument just about a year after the war was over.
Northeast of Shasta.
Yes, east of Shasta, somewhat north of Shasta. It's almost directly south from Klamath Falls, Oregon. Mm-hmm. It's right along the border between the two states. And so I found out John Muir had been there, and I thought this was just kind of curious. So I dug up the journalism he wrote on this particular trip and found out that he had written some terribly disparaging things about the Modoc people. And I thought that was really curious. But then again, these people were opponents in a war. And there was a lot of brutality that was widely reported in the press. And so I thought, well, maybe he changed his attitude about Indian people later. So I went looking through all of his writings and his career insofar as I could find people talking about him, and discovered that no, that the pattern that he had come to in this visit to the Lavabeds, this very denigrating, down the nose, not quite violent, but disliking deeply of the Native American tribes, was very profound, and it was, with one big exception, true simply all the time, particularly for the tribes in California, which he had the most experience.
Let's backtrack to Yosemite, because he's synonymous with modern-day
Yosemite. He is indeed. I mean, the curious thing was, when he was in Yosemite, which is between 1868 and when he leaves there to go up to take this really a long walking trip, a reporting trip up around Mount Shasta, he had been living there for about 5 years. And at the time, even though Yosemite had been kind of cleared out of many of the Native people, many of them had filtered back in, because in the aftermath of the gold rush, they were looking for safe places they could live. There was an ongoing genocide. Curiously, the park area, which became a park in 1864, the state of California began running Yosemite Valley for the federal government. And there were about 200 to 300 Native people living in Yosemite Valley. And they were working in hotels. The men were building trails and fishing and hunting for the dining rooms, and the women were doing mostly cooking and hotel maid type work, right? In all that time, Muir mentions exactly one indigenous person, a guy named Indian Tom, also known as Bridgeport Tom, because he was a Paiute from the other side of the mountains. And he took the mail in and out of Yosemite Valley during the winter, particularly. And he worked for the same man, Hutchings, that Muir did when he was running a sawmill. It was as if the Native people who were there living in their villages and still conducting a relatively continued life of what they had had beforehand simply were not there. He ignored them, and he just looked right past them. And it's also in Yosemite, he had one particularly interesting confrontation.
You alluded to he had an utter disdain for the indigenous people there, partly just because they were so poor and so dirty.
Yes.
Talk to us about that for a
moment. Yeah, his reaction to them often is to talk about filth. I mean, it's very curious. The most telling confrontation he had more of a confrontation than it was a meeting. During his very first summer in the Sierra Nevada, he was up in the Tuolumne Meadows area, and the man he was working for, Pat Delaney, said, "Why don't you take a day off, or 2 days off, and hike down Bloody Canyon to Mono Lake?
This is when he was sheep herding?
He was sheep herding, yeah. His job really was to keep an eye on the shepherd, as much as anything. So he does this. He starts down Bloody Canyon, which connects between near Tuolumne Meadows down to Mono Lake. And he gets into the canyon, and up come a bunch of people that he refers to as Monos, who are actually typically, they're more properly Mono Lake Paiute people. And he describes them as having these strange wallowing motion like bears and being dressed in these weird things. And at first, he isn't really sure they're people. Honestly, he says, I realized they really were human, which is astounding. And he describes then they were very dirty. What they were wearing was these clothing made out of rabbit skins, which is that's what they wore. And he told this story 5 times in the course of his career, over and over and over. He talked about whether sometimes they begged him for whiskey and tobacco, which he didn't have any. Again, records them as being filthy. And there's this telling line that comes out when they leave him and they're walking away. And he says, quote, "Somehow they seemed to have no right place in the landscape, and I was glad to see them fading out of sight down the pass."
Wow.
Period. End quote. And that line he uses in 3 or 4 of these tellings, and it becomes a marker towards how he related to indigenous people. Somehow they seemed to have no right place in the landscape.
But again, this is California, you know, Indians, because yeah. You have a whole chapter about his time in Alaska. A very different experience.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to see the contrast and why that contrast exists. All in all, he made 7 trips to Alaska in the course of his life. The first 2 were really the most telling because he was in dugout canoes with a local Presbyterian missionary named S. Hull Young. And they had Tlingit crews for the canoes were owned by Tlingit people, the native people in southeast Alaska, who were a very large, highly complicated and extremely successful tribal nation. Both these trips extended between 6 and 8 weeks. So he's really spending close-up time, and they're kind of leapfrogging in the way Tlingits paddled long distances from village to village to village to village and meeting people along the way. And because he's with a bunch of Tlingit people, there's no hostility. Even though Tlingits had a reputation for being seriously violent when they needed to be. I mean, that was kind of their way. And he was profoundly impressed with the Tlingits. He found them extremely forthright, honest. He was particularly impressed with the ways they dealt with their children. He was raised in a terribly abusive household. His father was a Calvinistic tyrant, and that's being kind, who beat John repeatedly. He watches the Tlingit people who never raise their voices to their kids. They will say things like, "Oh, that wasn't so good, was it?" You know? And they use example, they instill them with lessons, and they shape their behavior, but they never hit them. And he said something about he never heard a child crying in a Tlingit home. And they lived in these long houses, these big, great big long houses. Mm-hmm. That really stood out. And he had this deeply, almost reverent, I mean, he still was the white man carrying a white man's burden, but there was a reverent attitude towards these people that he had. After, when he's writing Travels in Alaska, he talks about the Tlingits a little bit, and he says, but you have to remember, they're not like other native peoples.
Interesting.
They look like Mongols to me. They're different. Well, he's just plain flat wrong. And if he'd done some research, he would have realized that they speak Nadene, a Nadene tongue, which is related to Navajo and Apache, and in California to Yurok. And so they actually are closely related to the tribes in the western United States. Sometimes they can even be interintelligible occasionally. Someone speaking Navajo could possibly understand someone speaking Tlingit. So the notion that they're different is wrong. They're not. These are just as like if you had a, you know, 2 bunches of people from northwestern Europe. They're somewhat similar, but they're basically the same kind of people, right? But what he fails to see consistently is that it had to do with the different histories and situations these people are in. The California Indians were dealt with, there was a genocide in this state. I mean, that's not even an argument anymore. It started in 1851, and it went really almost until 1900, in which there were armed militias that went out after native tribes and killed them off. There were slaving raids. There was distinct native slavery in the state. There was a tremendous issue to impoverish them. all the treaties that they had signed with the federal government were hidden in a secret archive and weren't even discovered until 1905. And so the tribes were left with nothing. They were impoverished. They were killed back from when the United States became the controlling power of California in 1846. There were about 150,000 native people.
When was the massacre in Clear Lake?
That was a classic case of what happened in that time. That was a case where there were two ranchers who ran this large spread near Clear Lake. They were enslaving two tribal groups, Pomo people primarily. And, you know, they raped the women at will, and they enslaved the men, and they punished anybody who got in their way. And they murdered people just right and left. And one of their Indian workers either stole or hurt a horse. And rather than wait for the retribution they knew was going to come, they ambushed these two guys and killed them. One of them was named Kelsey. There's now a town called Kelseyville up there, which is probably going to change its name, interestingly. If you can imagine, there was then the native people who were working on this ranch gathered all the food they could, and they took out for the hills. So the military came in response, and they began just killing anybody they ran into as, of course, guilty. They ended up killing about 1,000 people. The worst one was this massacre in what is now called Bloody Island in Clear Lake, where they cut them off from the mainland. And then just came through systematically and killed everybody they could. And only a few people were able to swim away. That was it. And that kind of massacre kept happening.
This was a posse. This was not, you know.
Actually, that was the military.
The United States
That was
Army.
The United States military. It was a battalion or a company of dragoons.
Wow.
Yeah. There were these formal military operations. Mm-hmm. There also were these vigilante posses who were supported by the state. During the 1850s, the largest expenditure in California was for money to pay for Indian killing militias.
Wow.
That was the biggest line item in the budget. I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing. And it came out to a total in today's dollars of about $55 million, which was paying for weapons, ammo, horses, I mean, you know, food, et cetera.
And a lot of that has to do with something that you write about. The first governor of the state of California.
Yeah, Peter Burnett, who was a really interesting guy. I mean, if you've seen pictures of him, he looks like Paul Newman. I mean, he had these blazing blue eyes and was kind of handsome. He was a really good-looking guy. But he had a history. He came from what they call the Little Dixie portion of Missouri, which was slaveholding. He first went to Oregon, and he was campaigning up there to keep black people out of the state. Then he comes to California because he was an attorney. He thought there was more opportunity here. And he eventually becomes the governor of the state. And he makes this speech on January the 7th, 1851, State of the State speech. He spends almost two-thirds of it on what he called the Indian problem. And he says that the only way this is going to be resolved is what is absolutely inevitable, and that is there is going to be a war of extermination. There's nothing the white man can do to stop it. This is inevitable. And so we might as well just go with the flow and wipe them out. I'm adding quite a bit there. But it happened. I mean, within days, the California legislature funded its first militia, which curiously was the one that cleared the native people out of Yosemite Valley. So there's a connection right there. So you have Peter Burnett, and you have this militia, the Mariposa Battalion. And then, you know, about 15 years later, here comes John Muir. He just shows up there, seeing the aftermath of that particular military action.
Talk a little bit more about Muir's time in Yosemite, and then segue to how the Sierra Club was founded. He was one of the originals.
Yeah, he has this really formative period in Yosemite from 1868 until 1874 is when he really leaves for sure. And he was working for a man named Hutchings who had a hotel. We're running a sawmill. He was a very good millwright. Muirhead was a very accomplished industrial engineer. He really knew how to make machines work. And so he was cutting timber to build little cottages and such for Hutchings and other tasks around the hotel. And he would then spend his off time wandering in the high country. That's where he really formed this attitude towards wilderness as this temple of the divine. Where I got the title, Cast Out of Eden, is that he really felt that when you go into the high country and you're looking at the glaciers and the granite, that you're looking at the way the earth was within moments of creation, that you're in Eden. And therefore, we had to preserve these spaces in order to make sure that there is this source of spiritual enlightenment that people can deepen their souls by going into that country. The interesting thing about that, of course, is what he's thinking of is white people can go into that country. And the native people have been living there for millennia really wouldn't know what I'm talking about, was what he would say. And so that's kind of where he began developing very strongly this attitude about what wilderness was, what its value was, and why, in some measure, it had to be indigenous free. He never advocates for the violent expulsion of any native group, but notice that oftentimes in his writing, he applauds when a native group is driven out.
Wow.
You know, like the Modocs, for example. And he talks about the other tribes in the area had been beaten into submission and were no longer posing a threat. You know, there was that attitude of they'll come and get us, you know. And so that's where he really developed this attitude about wilderness. And he happened to have really good timing, you know. But I mean, is Henry David Thoreau had said a lot of these things of, 40 years earlier, and they really kind of fell on in deaf ears in America. He developed this notion of wilderness quite had to be preserved, and he never, like I say, never advocated for a tribe to actually be thrown out, but he was always pleased when they were gone. In the 1880s, there was a growing awareness that America was being ravaged. I mean, that is huge. That's when you get the first incarnation of the Audubon Society. You get these climbing societies that are starting first in the Alleghenies and the Appalachians. Also, there's a formation of particularly the Boone and Crockett Club is the one that Teddy Roosevelt and Madison Grant and Henry Fairfield Osborne and these other luminaries of the East Coast Patrician Society were concerned about the big game animals being wiped out. And there was enormous concern about market hunting. All these things come together and there becomes what is really a fledgling environmental movement to preserve birds, to preserve wild landscapes, to preserve big game. And that's where the Sierra Club comes in there.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. It's part of a trend. And it becomes this, it's formed a little bit like these climbing clubs that were in the Appalachians, primarily, of basically rich sportsmen who wanted to spend their weekends bagging peaks. And that's sort of what it kind of formed as. But it became a little bit larger, and that began arguing for a wider sense of wilderness. And it formed in, I remember it was 1890 or 1892, right about the same time that Yosemite became a national park.
When did the Buffalo Soldiers show up?
They show up later. There's this curious reality around Yosemite where the valley was actually under the control of the state of California, even though it's federal land. It was a weird, this goes all the way back to the presidency of Abraham Lincoln.
So the federal had surrounding Yosemite, but the valley itself was state of California.
Yes. Control. And Muir was really important because he wrote two articles that were in the Century Magazine, which was the most influential magazine of the time. It was like even more so than, say, the New Yorker. I mean, it was a really, really influential magazine about Yosemite and why it needed to be preserved. And that his editor there, Robert Underwood Johnson, took these into the Congress and used them as the basis to lobby for the law that made Yosemite a national park. And it followed these, a little bit smaller than it is now, but it was basically all the surrounding area with this singular exception of the valley. And that bothered a lot of folks, particularly because the state of California was doing a terrible job of managing it. They were letting in all kinds of rapacious folks who were, they were turning it into kind of a granitic Disneyland. Mm-hmm. And that bothered Muir and it bothered other folks. There was an ongoing idea about, well, how could we get Yosemite Valley to be attached to the national park and become under that legal protection? So he goes on this famous camping trip with Theodore Roosevelt in the summer of 1903. And they end up with this picture that is repeated over and over, including in my book, of Muir and Roosevelt standing on Glacier Point. And Roosevelt more or less committed to the idea that the valley needed to be added to the national park. Then there's this whole backdrop that's going on where Muir is getting help from E.H. Harriman, who was the largest railroad baron in the country.
How did they connect?
Well, they had connected in 1899 on Harriman's Alaska expedition.
Oh, right.
And at first, Muir was like, oh, gosh, Harriman. I mean, he just sort of, you know, every little cynical, skeptical bone in his body was aroused. But they became very good friends and really had a genuine affection for one another. Harriman was the closeted Elon Musk of his time, right? I mean, he had a lot of influence, and he had a very good lobbying operation. And so his lobbyists took Muir's ideas and Roosevelt's sort of agreement, and they were able to get a law through. And Yosemite Valley was put into the park as of 1905. That meant it became within the province of the United States Army to protect it.
So that's when the Buffalo
Soldiers. And the Buffalo Soldiers come in. Units were brought out of San Francisco. There were typically two battalions or two troops. One was put typically around Yosemite and one more around Sequoia, and they patrolled the backcountry. They did some good work in that there were a lot of sheep herders who would take their animals up in there, even though it was illegal. And so the soldiers, the buffalo soldiers, developed this really good technique where they would catch a shepherd, and they would escort the shepherd to one side of the park, and they would escort the sheep to the other side of the park and release them and say, good luck, sucker.
Have fun. You
know? It really discouraged people. It was incredibly clever, particularly since a lot of these soldiers were black, and the non-coms were black, right? They had to be careful how they dealt, even though many of the shepherds were Peruvian or Chilean or Basque, and they did that. But the bad thing was they were breaking up tribal hunting camps that had existed in the high country, again, for millennia. They would typically ambush deer. They would, as they came down through the meadows, mm-hmm. as the weather got colder, they could lay in their whole winter supply of venison.
And this was the buffalo soldiers that were interdicting that.
Yes, when they would find Indians hunting mm-hmm. in the backcountry. They would round them up and drive them out. It wasn't necessarily, they weren't shooting at each other, but it was like, you guys got to go, and mm-hmm. we're going to make sure you're gone. Mm-hmm. And they kept doing this, and it became harder and harder and harder. And when here where you have people who have already been pushed to the absolute bottom, and they're losing an important food source, and their traditional ways of living are not being respected. In fact, mm-hmm. they're being denigrated. They're in a bad spot. And curiously, Muir applauded what they were doing, because they were doing this mostly up in the backcountry mm-hmm. where no tourist ever saw it, and they didn't see the implications of it. He never really comments, except he calls the native method of hunting deer to be lazy, uses that word specifically. And I think he'd been influenced by Teddy Roosevelt and this idea about how going after the really big buck, now that's the manly thing to do. Right. And if you're just potting the little ones and making smoked meat out of them, that's bad.
Question, Hetch Hetchy.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that and Muir's position.
Yeah, it's a long, difficult, terrible fight. The basis of it is that the Tuolumne River cuts this nice canyon in the northern part of Yosemite Valley. I mean, Yosemite Park, excuse me. It was about 22, 23 miles on a hiking thing from the valley over to Hetch Hetchy, which at the time was a valley that looked not unlike Yosemite Valley. It was smaller, more compact, and it had the advantage of having a lot of water pouring into it and having a very narrow in. The outpouring was very narrow. And so the city of San Francisco was looking for a water source. San Francisco has no water source. So they had gone around trying to buy up watersheds around the Bay Area, mostly done by private business, and then selling it to the city. There was these constant water wars. And so James Phelan, who was the mayor of San Francisco, got this idea that what they needed to do was build a reservoir, particularly in the Sierra Nevada, in order to bring water all the way into San Francisco. And they thought they could do this for a reasonable amount of money. And he had his engineers go out and do various studies of feasibility. And one they really liked was Hetch Hetchy. It had all the right stuff. I mean, a lot of water, very rocky walls, a narrow outfall so that you could put one dam in it and it would back all this stuff up. And there was no explicit prohibition of this kind of public works project in a national park. It was implied that there shouldn't be, but it wasn't really explicit. And there was some precedent already for like building things across parts of national parks. And so Phelan and his guys began arguing that the dam should be put in, that Hetch Hetchy should be turned into a reservoir, and that was the highest possible use of this landscape. That sent Muir, who by this point is getting to be a rather old man, he's in his late 60s, early 70s at the time, and he's kind of wrapping up his career. He went pretty much apoplectic over that. I mean, that's the only way to describe it. He talks about if you flood Hetch Hetchy, it's like flooding all the cathedrals of Europe. And he makes this constant comment that this is a sacred landscape, that you dare not tamper with it, even though, of course, the native peoples there have been driven out. And nobody ever asked the tribal people who used that area what they thought of the dam or not the dam, mm-hmm. right? It's very typical. And this turned into a huge fight, and it went back and forth and back and forth. It looked for a time like Hetch Hetchy was not going to happen. The dam would not be built. John Muir actually took off and took a long trip that he wanted to. He's gone for 10 or 11 months to South America and to Africa. Then he gets back and he finds, oh, the politics has really changed. They didn't have an internet. He wasn't on his iPhone. He didn't really know what was happening. But the whole process was beginning to shift. And it did shift. And that fight, it split the Sierra Club, for example. Those who were against the dam had to pull out. And some of those who were most preservationists, as they're typically, had to come out and form their own organization so they could preserve what was in the Sierra Club. And in the end, the Congress passed a law to make Hetch Hetchy to make it a reservoir for the city of San Francisco, and Woodrow Wilson signed it. And John Muir died something like 10 or 11 months later on Christmas Eve, 1914. And it is said sometimes that it broke his heart, that's why he died. It's not quite true. I mean, he died of pneumonia. You know, he was 76 years old, and he'd had a series of lung issues. But it did kind of signify that there was this, how deep this fight was. And curiously, he almost won the big game, which is to say that no other large public works project has been built inside of a national park since. Mm-hmm. It somehow left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. And in the aftermath of that whole thing, too, the so-called organic law that defines the parks, makes the park service, that was all written into law. So there was a tremendous professionalization of park management that goes on after that. And so there's a way that Muir won. I mean, he lost Hetch Hetchy, but the bigger issue of how do we treat the parks? I mean, there was a similar issue in Arches National Monument in the 1950s or 60s, where there's one area there that's one of those classic Rocky Mountain parks, and they wanted to put a dam in there and build this huge reservoir. That idea got beaten, and part of it was because look at Hetch Hetchy. Look at what we lost. The similar thing happened at Glen Canyon, but there was a different legal situation. Yeah.
And today, periodically, you hear pop up people advocating to take out Hetch Hetchy.
Yes. I don't know if it's going to happen.
Yeah, I doubt it.
I mean, there are very good arguments for that.
What does San
Francisco do? That's the really hard part of that. Mm-hmm. You'd have to be a really good civil engineer who really understands water resource management to see what all the alternatives. Yeah. At some point, the dam's going to, it silts constantly, yeah. right? So at some point, it's not going to be a usable source. Mm-hmm. So what happens then?
Contextually, when they built the pipeline, as you know, over by Livermore, mm-hmm. Sunol, and then off of 280.
Yeah.
Like Grecian temples.
Yes. The Pulgas Water Temple.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's a must see.
I've been there, it is. You know, I agree. It's really curious how, you know, that was a time of this progressive movement in politics, which was oftentimes internally contradictory. You know, it was Teddy Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot and a whole bunch of folks like that. And this was seen as a very enlightened use of a public resource. This is a continuing struggle in American politics. What is the best use of resources in wild lands, whether they be scenic or not, whatever their legal structure? We're still wrestling with it.
This is your fault for this question.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you have so much information in your book. You talk about Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
That one absolutely blew me away. The man was a screaming white supremacist. That's a piece of him I never heard about when I was studying American literature. I mean, you know, there's essays and so forth. But he has this book called English Traits, which is quite profoundly not only white supremacist, it's really that the people we would now call Anglo-Saxons or sometimes Aryans or sometimes Teutonic, I mean, depending on which particular white supremacist you want to use as your primary reference, they are somehow the dominant race in the world, and they're the ones who need to run the place, and everybody else needs to be subject to them.
And he tried to prove it.
He pretty much did, yeah. And I mean, he really argued for it. In this sense of context, he had a lot of support. There were people who were doing very similar work, calling it science, that the white race was. And by white race, they meant English people, German people, Scots, mm-hmm. lowland Scots, not highland Scots, and Scandinavians too. You know, that those were the folks who really should be running the place, and everybody else needed to be subject to them. That was a pretty widely popular idea that kept growing and growing and growing. And Muir incorporates it in a subtle way. I mean, he doesn't really come out with the same abject white supremacy that you see in Emerson. But he does, for example, make disparaging comments about the Irish, which I take very personally. He makes disparaging comments about Italians. Of course, he just overlooks most native peoples, just like they don't really exist. And he does the same thing when he's traveling abroad. Like when he was in South America, he gets helped by Mapuche Indians. He somehow never gets their names. In Africa, he's helped by a little African kid to find a baobab tree. Neglects to get the name. He gets the name of the guy who runs the hotel, but he doesn't get the name of the little kid who takes him to a baobab tree. And I see that as a constant level of where white people matter and everybody else doesn't. I mean, that's really a kind of core paradigm that is working in Muir's writings.
You spent years background research indirectly mm-hmm. on this book.
Yeah, it took 5 years.
Yeah. So all said and done, what filters to the top in your mind, in your brain, when you think of John Muir?
Oh, no, what is that? One is, he's really a complicated guy. Mm-hmm. We have to remember that. I mean,
think you'd like to hang out with him?
I'd be willing to try it. I mean, he, perfectly after he had a shower after a long walk. Okay. I mean, I do the same for him. So, he pretty was a fascinating conversationalist. I've understood that. And he was a very charming man. He had adored kids. He, probably because he was so abused as a little one, he adored his two daughters and went just bent over backwards to make their lives good.
Did you ever spend time in his house in Martinez?
I haven't. It's like 15 minutes from where I live.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
no kidding. And I've been in it, yes. It's an interesting place because you see the place where he put together most of his writings.
Feel the spirit of Muir when you're in there or no?
It's more like it's a very Victorian space, and you realize he's a very Victorian mind, right? I mean, I think that's part of it. Mm-hmm. And that's even part of where this white supremacy comes from. And it's an interesting place just to see. And they have various photographs of the man and so forth. But he also proved himself there. He was a terrifically good farmer. He was a terrific entrepreneur. He made a considerable chunk of money, became the largest table grapes grower in the state of California.
Wow.
And banked it all, you know. So he left a sizable bequest to his children as a result of that. What I like to talk to him about, though, is the good part about him is he did have this deeply mystical spiritual sense of the wild, which I think a lot of people who spend time in the wild know what he's talking about. And he was as good as anybody ever was at communicating that. Even if you didn't go take a hike way back up and climb Cathedral Peak, if you do it with him, you have a sense like you're there. He had a real gift for making a kind of vicarious experience of really deep backcountry, and he sort of pulled the wild in close. He also clearly had a big hand in preserving marvelous places. I mean, what I've heard called the God Rocks of Yosemite, which is a great term, and that was from a native writer. And he really did help to make sure that those places were not turned into granitic Disneylands. The sad part is that he has this white supremacist point of view that pushes the tribal people out of what had been their homelands. And that's an issue we're still dealing with. I would like to think that if I sat down with Muir now and brought him up to date, he might go something like, oh, I didn't really consider that. Because America's beginning to consider that. We're beginning to pull, the tribal people are getting more and more of a role in how national parks and national monuments are run. That is a really good thing. We're seeing the beginnings of what amounts to a new paradigm.
You were talking earlier about that happening in Yosemite mm-hmm. Valley today.
Yeah. There's a consultation agreement. The Park Service has to consult with people whose homelands they essentially manage, right? There are 7 identified Yosemite tribes. Some are federally acknowledged, some are not. And they are consulted about what's going to happen. Unfortunately, that's not a very powerful position to be in, because what that means is the Park Service decides what it's going to do, and then it has a meeting with the tribes and says, this is what we're going to do. So they're trying to get it. It's shifting some, though, with one particular group, which is the Southern Sierra Miwok Nation. These are the people who are the descendants from the Yosemites, and then before them from the Awanichis. And they have had an agreement, and they're not federally acknowledged. They have had an agreement with the Park Service since 2018 to build this village called Wahoga, which was the last place the tribes occupied.
And that's going on right now?
Yeah, right now it's going on. They're building a ceremonial roundhouse, and they're putting up a series of called Umachas, which are their traditional dwelling. They're going to use it as a kind of a tourist stop and a way of telling people about what Yosemite is about. And the tribal chair of the Southern Sierra Miwoks, Sandra Chapman, said to me, we really want tourists to understand that Yosemite did not begin with John Muir. And she said that with a certain level of kindness, but also like she's very clear. Mm-hmm. And these people are now, they're still pressing for federal acknowledgement. They don't yet have it. They have a petition in right now. I'm actually going to be in a conference call tomorrow with the attorney who's running that with the hope that that happens. If they get that, that will make them sovereign, which gives them a lot more power with the Park Service. Let's keep our fingers crossed that mm-hmm. they get acknowledgement and they will have an even more powerful relationship inside the valley. And that would be once again, a good thing, because it would draw a lot of their knowledge in there and also help them economically from things like guiding and other sorts of tourist service that they could mm-hmm. be providing.
Interpreters,
the whole mm-hmm. language teachers. I mean, a whole lot of things that could be going on.
That's really cool. Yeah,
it is really cool. And the people I talked to, like Scott Gediman, who's the PR guy at Yosemite National Park, are very behind it. They think this is a great idea. So I think it's probably going to happen in some form.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Okay. We could go on forever, but I think we're going to have to do a part two. Okay. We never even got to your other book.
Oh, well, that's around next time. Okay.
So to learn more about the world of Robert Aquinas McNally, where would you take us?
You can go to my website, ramcnally.com is the best place. I've got all kinds of stuff, good stuff on there, including a downloadable press kit. And also things like the events I'm doing, because I'm still doing talks and bookstore presentations around the book. That's a good place to go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been great.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, illuminating. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We've been speaking with Robert Aquinas McNally, the author of Cast Out of Eden.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York, and in fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.